So here it is, Fourth of July weekend. We hope that you make the most of it. It's a great weekend for camping out there somewhere in the woods. There must be somebody with a Sea Crane radio in their back pocket, or they're propped up by the camper, and by the flickering firelight, they're listening to Coast to Coast. And for them, especially, tonight's show is intended. Some campfire stories about vampires. One from a real vampire, the Weiser Field Guide to Vampires, written by J.M. Dixon. We'll talk more about the true life of vampires in America in just a few minutes. But then I do want to get back a little bit into vampire lore. Is when vampires get together and they tell stories of vampires, what stories do they tell? Coming up this hour on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. J.M. Dixon is the author of the Weiser Field Guide to Vampires. He is also a vampire that practices now psychic vampirism exclusively. This is the taking of energy, the taking of one's life force, usually in a voluntary relationship, sometimes in a passive relationship where he goes to crowds and takes energy from crowds, but was a former blood feeder himself. How many vampires are blood feeders, Jeremy?
Oh, wow.
What percentage do you think?
If I were to guess, I would say less than 25%. The
Okay.
vast majority of modern vampires today, while they are capable of drinking blood, choose not to, prefer to psychically feed instead. It
Is
is a little bit easier. It's obviously a lot more legal, and it has other benefits as well.
drinking blood is old school.
Yes and no. If you follow with the story of the battle between the Xi and the Tuatha De Danann, that seems to suggest that psychic feeding was much older, and the curses that were laid upon vampires by the Tuatha De Danann makes them have to blood feed. But that's a story.
I need to hear that story, because you spoke in a kind of code there that I'm sure where I it's maybe it's a little esoteric still for me to understand quite. How is it that they were, what was the dynamic that was going on between the she and the others that they should end up being cursed to have to drink blood?
Well, according to the story as it was translated by Elizabeth A. Gray, the Second Battle of Magtrid, and pardon me if I'm not pronouncing that correctly, it's Irish, is the story of how the Tuatha De Danann took the island of Ireland from the Fomor, who were the warrior caste of the Xi being an old term for a vampire, or it is also used as a term for fairy, as in, wings and pixie dust and all that stuff. But even the word fairy comes from the concept that these were the fair-skinned people, which is, another reference to vampires. The story, as it's told in that book, in that legend, is that the Xi had been in Ireland for quite some time, and they lived there peacefully with the few other people that were there, which I believe were Inuit.
Inuit isn't like we think of as, like, you mean Eskimo?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, the Inuit people are all over that region up toward the north. They've just been pushed back by the European expansion.
I didn't know that. That's interesting. I'd never heard that.
So when the Tuatha De Danann came there, they were very skilled magical practitioners, energy manipulators, things like that. And they effectively offered to work with the Xi to teach them new things and to learn new things from the Xi in exchange for the island of Ireland. The deal that was struck was that a Xi would remain as the High King of Ireland, but the Tuatha De Danann would have the run of the land. The problem was is that it was a very young man that was put in charge as the High King, and he was one of these, you know, bad people, as you mentioned earlier, that was vampiric in nature but didn't use it wisely. It led to a battle between the Shi and or between the Fomor specifically, the warrior caste of the Shi, and the Tuatha De Danann. But before battle started, the Tuatha De Danann, as it's described in the book, knew that battle against the Fomor would be suicide. They likened it to sticking your hand in an asp's nest, or dashing your own head against a cliff. It was complete suicide to fight these vampiric creatures. So they used their magical abilities to lay 4 very strong curses on these vampires. Apparently only 2 curses stuck. One was that the sunlight would burn their skin and their eyes. The other was that no water in Ireland would quench their thirst. Now, this might be, you know, just a way of explaining away the way some people have, you know, this vampiric thirst, or they tend to be sensitive to sunlight. Or this could be an actual historical reference to where some of these weaknesses came from. Now, there is science behind these weaknesses, but this is an absolute, you know, wonderful story to help with understanding our history.
Are there modern vampire leaders amongst your people now, people that are respected as like a vampire king in the United States today?
I would definitely say that we have a bit of an elder-led society, not necessarily people that are older than others, but respected individuals in the community tend to have the community's ear. You know, Michelle Bellanger is a respected individual. She is respected both as a writer and as a vampire. She, you know, works with the community in 100 different ways. And then there's also people like Don Henry, who have gained significant popularity and use that popularity and public image almost as an ambassadorial concept. He himself may not necessarily be a highly respected individual in the community, but being well known, he uses that responsibly and uses it as a way of informing the rest of the population what a vampire is.
What keeps him from being well respected by vampires?
I wouldn't say that there's anything that keeps him from being respected. He is he definitely portrays the vampiric image quite thoroughly. You know. Pale skin, long fingernails, sharp teeth, all that stuff. His profession, I believe, is that he's a model, like a gothic model. But, you know, Michelle Bellanger, obviously, she gained her respect from the community by, you know, writing books and public speaking, giving lectures. You know, she's extraordinarily well-educated. I have no idea how many degrees she has.
Right. What about Jonathan the Impaler Sharkey, the vampire and Luciferian who runs for president all the time? He was, when he lived here in my home state here, Minnesota, he ran for governor, and he makes national news, gets on, you know, cable TV and stuff like that from time to time. What about Jonathan Sharkey? What is he thought of by other vampires?
Lord, I was hoping you wouldn't bring him up. Sharkey, he would be, I have an entire section in my book on people that are confused for real vampires, either people that claim to be or, you know, are confused by others to be. Regardless of his claims, he doesn't behave like a typical modern vampire does. He is rather extraordinary, rather extreme.
In the founding of the Vampires, Witches, and Pagans Party, is that not something that vampires might be inclined to join as a political party?
Probably not, in fact. I think that vampires tend to, you know, throw their weight behind things that are, you know, well-established or, you know, well-ambitious on their own. I mean, there might be an extraordinary number of Democrats amongst vampires, but, you know, backing a smaller political party with very little influence in the government. Doesn't seem to be a very profitable situation to us.
Are there conservative vampires?
I'm sure there are.
I mean, Tea Party vampires?
Possibly. I mean, I'm from the South myself, and you know, I wouldn't at all be surprised if there were plenty of people that, you know, have their own ideas and their own ways, and you know, vampiric or not, we are all individuals, and we make our own decisions about our own lives and our values.
Do vampires believe in God?
Hard to say. Every vampire that I've spoken with tends to be of a very scientific mind. Now, of course, mind you, you know, there is not a separation between religious concepts and science. Sometimes scientists are, you know, very religious individuals that are really trying to understand the creation of God. Me personally, I'm not a religious individual. And as a vampire, I have done my best to thoroughly research the history of vampires. I find it hard to believe, personally, that there could be an individual God that is all-knowing, all-powerful, all-everything, when through the history of vampires, vampires have been called gods more often than anything else.
Vampires have been called gods by whom?
In ancient Sumer, they were referred to as, I can't remember the name right offhand, but it was a word that was specifically referring to them as both half spirit and half human, which made them deity creatures. In ancient Egypt, a lot of the gods could be associated with vampires, and certainly the rulers had that same concept. They were supposed to be half human and half god. In fact, throughout the history of humanity, there have been references to individuals that were half some sort of spiritual being and half human, which made them into these vampiric creatures. Even the Christian Bible references the Nephilim, which were children born to human women from the copulation with angels.
Well, it's yeah, maybe a little more complicated than that. But it's in the Hebrew Bible, but it's also in the Christian Bible too. But
of course,
that's okay. So, but when you but then does that make you half human, half God?
Well, I think that the concept that a vampire is half physical and half spiritual is a very good mental idea of how our lives are. For a vampire, especially a psychically feeding vampire, to live a healthy and full life, he kind of has to live half in this world and half in the next. We have to be very aware of our spirit all the time and its capabilities and its nature to live a healthy, normal life. We can't be purely concerned with the physical.
Well, I'm caught a little bit here in what may seem like a paradox, so sort this out for me. If vampires tend to be of a more scientific mind, and if vampires tend to be more agnostic to atheistic when it comes to an all-powerful God, then what is the source of the spirit, and what is this next world of which you speak?
Well, when I refer to half in this world and half in the next, I'm really just more the concept of the disembodied spirit.
Okay, but what's the seat of that soul? What's the, I mean, I understand it from a Judeo-Christian standpoint, the idea of the separation of body and soul and whatever, but what's the matrix for your belief in a disembodied spirit? To what is it connected, or toward what is it going?
Well, I don't think it really has to go anywhere or be connected to anything. I think the concept of I think, therefore I am is very strong here. A spirit, any spirit, in my opinion, if I can come up with a good metaphor here, is more like a tornado.
Okay.
So long as the conditions are fed right, it exists. It, you know, swirls its energy. It lives. It is a living entity, and as such will, you know, grow and evolve and change over time. If you believe in reincarnation, then, you know, once this becomes too weak, it has to reincarnate.
Well, okay, but a tornado is a dynamic force, but I wouldn't call it a living force. I mean, it doesn't have a, it's not sentient. It's not, it doesn't go, I think I'll get this house and not that house. It doesn't spring up out of nature, develop a mind of its own. We may think of it that way. We anthropomorphize tornadoes and we think that they're going after our neighbors and not us or vice versa, but they don't really in that sense. So how is it that then that your spirit, you know, if you are half of something and you are half spiritual, or that you are half, that what kind of God are you? I mean, what is it, what is the force? What is that divine force that allows you to speak in terms of a deity? What is it? Does it tie back to Lucifer? Are vampires Luciferians by nature?
Oh, no, certainly not. I mean, you know, I made references to Sumer, obviously. You know, if vampires are that old, then that predates any concept of Lucifer. But as for the tornado, as you said, it is a very simple thing. It's not complex. A spirit, a human or vampire, is an extraordinarily complex thing and exists on multiple frequencies. And as such, it has the ability to see itself, to feel itself, to choose to exist, to take in energy and live. I think that this complexity has developed over simple natural evolution. As, you know, DNA eventually worked its way up to be the highly evolved human that is today, so too the spirit had to just barely predate that DNA. It may have started as a very small swirl concept of a tornado, but it eventually found a cohesiveness and developed into something stronger and independent and eventually highly intelligent.
So as a vampire, is there the vampire hierarchy? Are there lower forms of vampirism that are considered legitimate, that you would consider these people to be vampires, but they are not very spiritually evolved, or they are ungodlike in the sense that they don't have, they're not the proper mix of body and soul?
I'm not sure I could go that far, but there are certainly people who, you know, are younger, who are newly awakened, have just discovered what they are, that don't really have control over what they can do yet. You know, there's a very old joke about how electronic equipment always seems to fail around young vampires, because that is the case. High energy containment in our spirits, combined with stress, eventually creates an electromagnetic pulse, which does a very good job of frying a computer on a bad day. I have experience with that myself.
So if somebody finds themselves hitting control alt delete a lot, or that they are, you know, forever running into problems with their appliances, could it be that they're a vampire and they just don't know it?
Well, that's certainly a possibility, and it's worth doing their own research on. But then again, they might just have a very old computer too.
Okay, but I mean, is it possible in 30 seconds, help me, is it possible that that one can spend one's whole life being a vampire and not know it?
Yes, it is absolutely possible. Vampires are capable of unconscious feeding, and as long as they're living in the right conditions that they can get the energy, they may never awaken. It's not the best situation, but it is possible.
The Weiser Field Guide to Vampires, Legends, Practices, and Encounters, Old and New, J.M. Dixon, is the author and a vampire. Well, I still want to get back to how do you properly pick a victim, and then, or donor, as it were, what's the criteria for that? And then also, what stories do you tell around the campfire? If you're getting together with other vampires, what stories do you tell to scare yourselves? Next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Well, as you can tell from the news, it's a vampire weekend. And 4th of July, notwithstanding, the big celebration, I think, for Hollywood is certainly the success of the Twilight series. $30 million on a midnight opening the other night, and huge box office continuing for the weekend, maybe one of the biggest box office openings of all time. And so it is that it's only sort of semi a coincidence. We're talking with the author of The Weiser Field Guide to Vampires. I read this book, I guess it came out about a month ago. And I was very interested. I kept thinking about it. And I kept looking around at people that I worked with and situations that I would encounter. And I kept thinking, I wonder if there's any vampires here. Or is that person a vampire? Or what would I do if a vampire revealed him or herself to me? And would I be a good victim slash donor for a vampire? Would I be a good vampire meal? We'll ask J.M. Dixon that next. He is both the author and a vampire himself on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. We'll get your questions for J.M. Dixon, Vampire, coming up next hour on Coast to Coast. The Weiser Guide to Field Guide to Vampires is out. You can link up to it at coasttocoastam.com. There's a story in the news about vampires. I want to get to that. We linked it up on our webpage. But before we do, would I make a good meal? And would I be a good victim slash donor for a vampire?
Well, I certainly think you probably would be. I mean, obviously, I mentioned earlier, I don't really drink from men or take energy from men generally, is not as a specific donor. But
why? Why won't you take a male meal from time to time?
Well, I tend to think that the healthiest way that you can have a donor is if there's someone who's already close to you, a good friend. And I've just never really maintained friendships with men. I just feel more comfortable in the presence of women. I don't know why.
Okay. But wouldn't that be like me deciding I'm not going to eat that steak because it didn't come from the right kind of cow? I mean, isn't energy's energy, isn't it? Life force is life force.
Probably, but this is also a psychological thing as well. I mean, not just the energy taking itself, but, you know, it can be an intimate experience, and you have to do that with someone you're comfortable with.
Sure.
But as for a good donor, it has to be somebody that has good, healthy energy, preferably someone who's intelligent, as you obviously are. Anybody who takes care of themselves, is open-minded, is, you know, of the ability to relax and let you take their energy, is definitely a good person.
Okay. And that's how you choose it. You look for somebody who has – you wouldn't take a meal of a psychic vampire meal. You wouldn't take that from somebody who had very low energy or who was depressed.
No, that would be very irresponsible. People who are depressed, obviously, are of low energy anyway. People who are already sick or aren't doing very well, or, you know, for whatever other reason, already have low energy, not only would that be a difficult and an unhealthy meal for us, but it wouldn't do them much good either. I think that as long as we are feeding, we have to do it in very responsible manners. And there has to be an equilibrium that's struck. I mean, you know, if we are, you know, if we do have the need to eat as much as, say, an elephant does, then everything around us will begin to grow bigger, faster, stronger to compensate. If you take from, you know, something or someone that is already weak, then there's the potential of doing serious harm to them, even permanent damage.
The ethical aspects of vampirism, is there a code for this that's actually written out for young vampires to be able to follow?
Yes. There is the concept of the black veil, which is just kind of a part of our society. It's something, you know, anybody can find on the internet. I think 13 rules of not just of responsible feeding, but of decorum in the community, because, you know, if there's one myth about vampires that's accurate, it is the fact that we are incredibly polite.
Vampires are polite?
Yes, absolutely.
Why is that true for vampires?
It's just a part of our nature. That whole, you know, not entering someone's home unless invited, that's pure manners. That's not about magical power.
So when you say you, because that is the legend, that a vampire can't come into your home unless you invite him or her into it. But once they're in, then you've opened the door for them to take from you. One of the beliefs of saying you don't invite somebody, you don't invite a vampire in, is that once they're inside, then you cannot fend off, you may not be able to fend them off. How is that polite?
Well, I think that's more a matter of personal fear than of a lack of politeness, because it's not just about, you know, the specific home, but it's about inviting people into your life. It's always intelligent to be cautious about getting close to people. I mean, you wouldn't, you know, sleep with a person unprotected if you didn't know for a fact that they didn't have an STD. You wouldn't let a vampire feed from you unless you were confident that they were going to feed responsibly and intelligently and stop taking if they were beginning to take too much.
I'm interested in this vampire list of commandments. Where would I find that?
My best advice to you is just to get on the internet and look up the Black Veil. I don't actually include it in my book because, you know, my book was less about the community and more about the actual individual vampire itself and how it operates.
How can I tell there's a vampire in my presence?
Most humans are rather good at sensing it. If you feel that someone, not, you know, psychologically draining, it, as in, you know, like how some of us have overbearing mothers, but it, if you feel that someone may be able to fixate you, able to draw attention, energy, everything to them, even though they're doing nothing physically to draw attention, then this may be a sign of a natural vampiric ability.
I'm coming across, I Googled the vampire code, the Black Veil, and I came across this website that talks about a new code. Can I read some of these to you and see if you want to comment on these? Whenever somebody directly asks you if you are a real vampire, always say yes in the same way and tone that they asked you. If they jokingly ask you, then jokingly say yes. If they yell the question at you, then yell at them the answer yes. How does that sound?
It seems a little absurd to hear it right offhand.
All right. But you are okay, I'm going to read you another one. So here, hang on. You are responsible for the actions of those that you have turned into a real vampire. Is that true?
There is no ability whatsoever to convert someone to vampirism. I think maybe you just have some bad information there.
Okay. It says here, never turn someone into a real vampire for any of the following reasons: to prove that vampires are real, to prove to them that they weren't already a real vampire, in hopes of curing them for an illness, because they simply want to become one, because they hate their life, and they think being a real vampire will magically fix it. These are all things that you don't, all reasons not to turn somebody into a real vampire. Do you agree?
I think that it's impossible to convert someone into a vampire, therefore I can't possibly agree with that.
If a fellow real vampire needs help, offer to help them even if they don't ask for it. We all know that we tend to wait until it's either almost too late or way too late before asking for help because of some natural instinctive cat-like logic reasoning. Where are you with that?
I tend to think that natural courtesy dictates that you should offer a helping hand to anyone that needs it, not just others of your own kind.
We're talking with the author of The Weiser Field Guide to Vampires, J.M. Dixon. So what stories is it that that vampires tell to scare each other? If you were sitting around a campfire with other vampires, what are the legends and stories that you share with each other?
I hate to disappoint, but unfortunately, if I were sitting around a campfire, I'd probably aim for more humorous stories. One of the major sources for my book, especially with the gypsy information, because I do include a magnificent story in my book that I only that I found just before I needed it for the final edit of the book. That's from a woman who is referred to by her family as Aunt Nia. She's from the Carbone de Travail gypsy family. It's not a story per se, because the book tells of the story of her sister Peranda, but I've always thought that Nia's life in and amongst itself was fascinating on its own. She's included in my glossary here. She died actually just before the book was printed, so unfortunately she never actually saw the book. But in her life, she received multiple degrees and doctorates. She was a senior member of a chapter of the Hell's Angels, at the same time holding a 15-year professorship at a respected California university.
Okay.
In fact, she died 1 week shy of her 98th birthday from an injury she sustained while teaching a course on bungee jumping.
Wow.
These are fascinating people.
I agree. I'm not sure I understand how that connects to the question of what stories do you tell when you're sitting around to tell other vampires, when you're talking with other vampires and you tell other vampire stories.
Well, I would think that telling the story of someone's life is much more fascinating than any horror story.
Are there horror stories for vampires?
Horror stories? I doubt it.
No horror stories for vampires?
Well, I mean, when you've grown up living your life with a lot of people afraid of you for no particular reason, there's not really a point in trying to scare people.
Okay. I'm reading a story from Colorado. It says here that a woman on the Western Slope is claiming that there are vampires in Colorado's Grand Valley. The woman says she spotted a vampire in the middle of a dirt road near Fruta, Colorado. Sunday night, she told Colorado State Troopers she was startled by the undead being, threw her SUV into reverse, and crashed into a canal. She was not injured. State Troopers say the woman's husband arrived at the scene and took her home. The vampire, which was not seen by anybody else, apparently let her get away. Troopers do not suspect drugs or alcohol to be factors in the crash. Is she telling the truth?
Well, I can't tell you what spooked her, but I definitely think the insurance would have a hard time buying that story.
Okay, but are there vampires that roam roads? Are there vampires everywhere that if she saw one, she would know it in a moment and would, out of fear like that, put the card? Does it have the ring of truth to you?
It seems very, very unlikely to me because, the average modern vampire doesn't look anything different than a perfectly normal human. The Romanian term for a vampire, Strigoi V, which is a living vampire, a modern vampire, perfectly normal, psychically feeding vampire, is described as being perfectly 100% human in form. There's nothing extraordinary or undead or, bizarre looking about us. If she, nearly ran over some, poor little kid who was all gothed out or punked up for the weekend, then, I'm glad she didn't kill the kid, but she definitely needs to be a little bit more careful with her driving.
So as a vampire, though, she mentions vampires in the Grand Valley of Colorado. Are there regions of the United States where there are more vampires per population than others? Are there sort of like, meccas for a young vampire to get to?
Well, there certainly are certain groups and organizations that tend to attract crowds to them. Michel Bélanger is a member, maybe even the person who started House Caperu, which is kind of a research group for the spiritual side of vampirism. There's in Atlanta, here in Georgia, the Atlanta Vampire Alliance, which is a group of vampires that is specifically dedicated to educating themselves about the science behind the vampire concept, and especially including, you know, the medical concepts. But
okay.
You know, anywhere where humans gather, there's going to be vampires.
So are there vampire clans?
I would say houses, organizations for, you know, people to lend a helping hand to one another. It's not really about, you know, hierarchy. It's more about the concept of responsibility to the community. Everybody wants to do something good for those people that may need a little bit more help, who don't have the education or don't have the know-how or the capability. And hopefully, you know, my book will be able to reach all those people who are nowhere near any place where they can get, you know, person-to-person, hands-on contact with another vampire.
The Weiser Field Guide to Vampires, J.M. Dixon is the author. So are there national vampire organizations like, you know, Rotary Clubs of Vampires, where one, if one wants to do service work, one can join a fraternity, as it were?
Not to my knowledge, but that certainly is a fascinating concept.
The vampires, I mean, you tell some interesting stories, especially about vampires of the past, and we've touched on a couple of these. In vampire lore, what was the golden age of vampires?
That's very hard to say. I would, if anything, say now, today, because today is the first time, you know, throughout the entirety of history where, you know, I can get on a radio show that has, you know, over 525 stations across the U.S. and talk about, you know, my condition as it is, who I am, without trying to, you know, claim that I'm superior to everyone else or have to, you know, prove myself or, you know, all that sort of thing. If I were in ancient Sumer, I would have, by my nature, immediate responsibilities to the community. Being a vampire wouldn't just be who I am. It would be a job. So I think the modern era is absolutely best because there is more information out there than ever before. There is more access to this information than ever before. And certainly there are plenty of people who aren't open-minded, but I think that intelligence and education and all of this has gotten to a point that most of the world is open to new ideas and, you know, new ways of seeing the world and open to the concept that, you know, not all people are exactly alike.
Do vampires have are there agendas in the world of vampirism where, for example, I just to make an easy comparison, where you want to say, you know, change the way that the laws are written that would allow vampires to drink blood, and on the basis that this is a lifestyle choice, this is a free society, that you want to be able to drink blood because it's part of your spiritual practice, that by preventing vampires from drinking blood doesn't prescribe to the dictates of separation of church and state, or that you want, are there any insurance allowances that you would like to have as a vampire that you're not accorded right now? What do you think? Any of those?
Well, not any of those to my knowledge, but there certainly is the concept in the vampire community, much as there is, say, in the gay community, about creating a positive public image and making sure that people don't have misconceptions about us.
Okay, but why not say it's discrimination to prevent vampires from feeding on blood? If this is who you are, and this is what you do, or at least some of them, in a free society, how can we stop somebody from drinking blood?
Well, because we have an alternative to blood. If a person does live in a state, such as Georgia, where drinking blood is illegal, there are alternatives. A person can educate themselves on how to psychically feed. And other than that...
Is blood drinking prevented in South Carolina or in Alabama?
I'm not certain right offhand.
I wonder if there are vampires that are crossing state lines to drink blood. All right, let's go. The Weiser Field Guide to Vampires. We'll get to your questions and comments coming up for author J.M. Dixon. I'm not done either, so I've got some more I may pepper in the middle of your questions and comments next. on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett.